I think it's, I really do think it's a providential thing. And I think that it's going to be challenging, but I think it's God's way to use that facility now. Mm. So.
So I'm here today with Larry Richardson, the president and CEO of the YMCA of the Roses, which serves both York and Lancaster. Is that right?
That's correct.
Did I get that right? Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Thanks for answering my questions. This does sound like a reporter interview. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. It's all right. Yeah. I anticipated to be a conversation, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm also here with Jason Burgess, our intrepid media guy, who is in charge of all things podcast.
Yeah, you may not hear me too well.
Probably can't. Sorry. I don't have a third.
I can add that in.
Yeah. So thanks for answering my questions. Listener, if you're not familiar with the situation, Otterbein United Methodist Church is going to be the host or the landlord for a new low-barrier emergency shelter for unhoused persons. It's going to be in the basement of Otterbein Church. And the YMCA is going to be, well, tell me what you guys are doing for it.
I think basically, high level, we're going to be the service provider at the shelter. So we'll work for the Homelessness Coalition and provide the services or the sheltering services from, 7 o'clock, approximately 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. every night, making sure that there's a safe place and everybody is safe that's there, and just providing the services itself.
So you provide the staff. Mm-hmm. And the operating procedures and the care. Is that kind of what it is?
I think there'll be some other things involved. In other words, we'll have some laundry services, there'll be shower services. So we'll make sure that we're ushering people to the proper places. Also, I think the key thing is safety and security, making sure they feel safe and secure, everybody from one another and themselves. And also our staff feel safe and secure, and that the community is safe and secure. So I think a lot of that is being sure that we're empathetic, but also accountable to each person that's coming in, to making sure they're cared for. So that could involve anywhere from doing their laundry to assuring their personal belongings are safe and secure, because that's a big thing for homeless people. Whatever it is that they have, and though they don't have much, it's very important what they have is secure for them. So things like that.
Can you tell me, so it sounds like you, the YMCA has, this is not new. Mm-hmm. This concept of a shelter is not new to the YMCA. And the other day when I met you, you mentioned that this is not new to the YMCA as a whole. Mm-hmm. You have a long history. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, so let me qualify that. The low barrier shelter is somewhat new. It's kind of an extension of things that we've already been done. But the YMCA in York, which is part of the YMCA of the Roses, has been doing housing since 1925. And probably even before that, if I were to look back and see what some of the specialties were. But we built a new Y in 1925. That building will be 100 years old next year. And it has 120 single room occupancies. Now, back in the day, after World War I, a lot of YMCAs built really what they were hotels. Mm-hmm. We were the largest hotel provider in the world. And post-World War I, and then even World War II, we had a lot of, and this ours was always men, were a lot of veterans that were coming back from the war. And during the Depression, the same thing. And when I came to York in 1994, we were not being good stewards of the resources there. We really were a slum landlord. Okay. It was generating income, revenue over expenses in a profitable way, but I didn't feel good about how it matched with our mission. So we started looking for alternative uses and alternative services, if you will, and really determined that we needed to do, if we really were going to shelter men, that we needed to do a better job of not just giving them a roof over their head, but also providing services. So we needed to get in somehow. We were going to be able to afford case management services. Mm-hmm. And generally what we were finding was mental health services and substance abuse. So we don't have them internally. So we had to look at the continuum of care of other agencies to be able to provide that. But we had to also address the physical confines of the facility and what its focus was. So went through a long, arduous process and ended up creating a homeless men's shelter under HUD guidelines, an $8 million renovation, total renovated the entire place, and including rooms for disabilities, including rooms for, at the time, AIDS was a big thing in the mid-90s for AIDS patients, and separate rooms and case management areas and recreational spaces and kitchen spaces where they could, you could come and you could live there. Mm-hmm. But you had to be homeless. Mm-hmm. A man had to be designated homeless under HUD rules. So then we were able to provide caseworkers, case management services, and we've been doing that since around 2000 in this site. And we've always been about 90 to 96% occupied. Mm-hmm. It's always been a high need. And in York, anyways, it does take off those who would formerly have been homeless, defined as you want. You could be homeless under the bridge, in the park. It could be sleeping on someone's couch.
Sure.
A lot of them are now at the Y. And we provide the community for them. We have wraparound 24/7 services and around security, case management, and we have people that are there. And it is a very tight community in that building. And inside the 120, six of our units are emergency shelter units that will work with the city police, or we'll work with friends and neighbors, other outreach workers. If somebody's homeless and needs shelter, we can house them. And we'll actually house them in those emergency shelter units, I think up to 6 weeks. Mm. And we work with LifePath, which is the mission program in York that also provides those services. So while we've not done low barrier, we have done shelter. We know what low barrier means. We've worked with low barrier clients. So this is a little bit different stretch for us, but it's not like we weren't already up to our waist in the water, if you will, or in experiences. Yeah. So I don't think it's a big stretch for us to consider.
So I understand, you're talking about the shelter in York, and it sounds like there are a few different connected services mm-hmm. that are a part of that. What sort of things have you learned in your experience there that you'd like to see put in here?
Mm-hmm. I think the key things are, one is you have to have a community of people that are going to be empathetic to the homeless population and view them as people. And in York, we have that. Because you're going to have an element of people that discard them as, I don't want to say humans, but as value, as valuable people. And that's who they are. And they've whatever has led them to be homeless, and we find that most often it's some type of mental health issue, or it's some type of substance abuse problem. Generally, those are the two biggest. And mm-hmm. then the outlier would be somebody that doesn't have one of those two backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And so what I've found in York is we know who the people are that are they're going to be empathetic and view these people as qualified people. And we see it as part of our mission. It's pretty simple. We're a Christian-based organization. We're not evangelical. We're ecumenical, how we administer that. And, we love God, love others, and we don't ask any other questions.
Yeah.
So it's key for us to have partners that have that same mentality and same focus. And so in York, over the years, we've established that. We know who they are. Mm-hmm. In Lancaster, in this particular case with a low-barrier homelessness shelter, and I actually said this in a public meeting Tuesday, and I said it a few weeks ago, I'm impressed because there has been different domains that have come together. You have the business community for different reasons, mm-hmm. right? The business community, the Homelessness Coalition, which is, I think, 70 different groups in Lancaster County. You have the benevolent community that's interested. I've seen several of the very large foundations at these community meetings. You have the faith community that's involved, the social services community that's involved.
Yeah.
You have county government, you have city government, which they don't agree to much in Lancaster County, which is similar to York County. York City government and York County government, are not often on the same page.
Yeah.
And so this is one where I see all these people coming together in a community this size, which is is dealing with this homeless population, this homelessness issue, not indifferent to other cities across the country. It may be magnified more in Philadelphia or Baltimore or New York because it's just more people.
Right.
But how do you handle it? And I don't know what they're doing in other places, but from my perspective and what I know in other communities at YMCAs, or there's not many YMCAs involved in this work, but those who are, I think would be, I don't know if jealous is the right word, but envious that a community has come together.
And these
people are on divergent areas. You know, we want to talk about, and there's no doubting that the country is divided in a lot of ways.
Sure.
But in this case, I see all those people in one room with very divergent mindsets about a lot of things. But in this one thing about homelessness, how can we resolve? And they come from different perspectives and they come for different reasons. But they're all willing to listen to one another. And I've seen nothing but respect in these meetings.
Yeah.
Respect for the business community, respect for the homeless person, respect for the social service providers, you know, respect for the business owners, respect for the people who live here, respect for the people who do business here, respect for the tourist who wants to come here. Mm-hmm. And so that to me is pretty impressive. And I think if you start there, you can work your way through whatever challenges are going to come up, because there are going to be a lot of challenges in this.
Yeah, that alignment it's surprised me
mm-hmm.
a little bit. And, mm-hmm. and I think that's part of what attracted me to being appointed at Otterbein, mm-hmm. that they were already, you guys, Jason, were already in the process of mm-hmm. Figuring out how to put a shelter there. And I kept asking probing questions of the previous pastor, the leadership. Are you sure this is, mm-hmm. you know, I guess I was waiting for the shoe to drop.
Yeah, sure.
And no, I mean, there are people with questions.
Sure.
There are people with concerns. You know, this shelter is going to be in my neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
you know. But almost every person I've spoken to, including the neighbors that I have knocked on doors and met with, they're like, yeah, about time. We're mm-hmm. kind of looking, people need this to open.
Yeah.
So that's been encouraging. What are one or two popular misconceptions about shelters that you run into, and how do you help people understand those misconceptions differently?
I think probably there are misconceptions. This is like the 80-20 rule, right? The Pareto principle and anything else. You're going to have 20% of the potential clients that are going to come there that maybe could be disruptive to the neighborhood or to the shelter itself. But the vast majority of them are just looking for a safe place to stay.
Okay.
They're looking for a community. They're looking for people that are going to care for them and care about them and aren't going to judge them about anything. But I think there are going to be, you know, the misconception is that 100% of them are trouble or causing trouble,
okay.
which normally is not the case. I think even in my experience, be it in York or Lancaster or walking streets of Philadelphia, and I've been around in New York or wherever, and you see a homeless encampment or you pass by a homeless group of folks and there's 10 people, you know, not all 10 people are harassing you, or it's a small minority,
yeah.
but it represents that population. So all of a sudden it becomes a big deal. If you have people that are, and I heard this the other day, urinating and defecating and causing a public health concern outside of a business, and there's 100 homeless, you know, it's not 100 people
that are doing that.
It's a small minority, but they're representative of the population. So the misconception becomes all of those people mm-hmm. are causing all those disruptions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one of the key things. The other thing is that I think there's a misconception that in today versus homelessness 20 years ago is these people are choosing to be homeless.
Okay.
And I think that to a true degree, again, a small minority of them just want to be left alone and want to be homeless. That's just their lifestyle. And again, for whatever reasons, a lot of the times mental health reasons play into that. But I believe, and the data I think shows it, and we've been talking about this in the Homelessness Coalition, the current economic conditions have created, and this isn't a political statement, this is a reality
sure.
of the current economic conditions and how housing has changed in terms of pricing. Home ownership or rental, doesn't really matter. Rentals have really increased, even affordable housing rents are becoming unaffordable. And wages have not kept pace, even though wages have increased, they've not kept pace with inflation, despite what the reports were this
sure.
week. They just haven't. And so that bottom tier of people, that 20% of people that have been on the bottom rung on the economic ladder, it doesn't take much for them to fall out of housing.
Yeah.
And next thing you know, they're barely making their rent, or they're barely making their mortgage payment, or they're, you know, they're pairing up with other people and sharing expenses. It doesn't take much. One person loses a job, there's a, you know, a broken relationship in a home, it doesn't take much for those people to drop out of that bottom 20% and soon they're homeless. And so how do they find it? So one of the keys is for us in our homelessness shelter is we want men to come there. And if that becomes their community forever, that's fine. But really the success for us is to move them out of the shelter into a rental, maybe someday into their own home.
You know, using wraparound services.
Services of other groups and connections.
On-ramps and transitional housing.
Yeah, people were ready for it. Yeah, some guys aren't. In our case, some people are not. Yeah. And that's okay too. We're going to make sure that they're safe and they feel good. Sometimes we'll have, quite often, we've been doing this for so long, quite often a man in our place will be there. He'll be there several years and they die there. Just like if people would at their homes, right? Mm-hmm. That's become their home. And the funeral or the services will come up and we'll be the only people there, our staff.
Yeah.
Or have the relationship. Men from that community. That's yeah. their community. And that's okay too. And that's fine. So the homelessness group of people, let's just say the targeted group that might be here in Lancaster, they are a community. Mm. They know who one another are. And the street workers know who everybody is too. If you talk with some of the people, the outreach workers, they know who the people are. And so that is a way they're looking to these people. And I come back to what I said earlier with empathy and that they're people and should be treated with care.
I think that kind of speaks to one of the misconceptions I've run into and is that idea that they are a problem to solve.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not be something explicitly they say, mm-hmm. we need to solve these homeless people mm-hmm. being in the community. It's not usually said that explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea that homelessness is a problem to solve, therefore these homeless people are a problem
mm-hmm.
in need of a solution.
Right.
And that doesn't strike me as correct. It seems like they are a people that exist.
Mm-hmm.
They're a human that just wants to love and have relationship and
right.
wants safety when they can get it.
Mm-hmm.
That all of the things that cause homelessness to rise and fall, you know, as a percentage, maybe it's economy, maybe mm-hmm. it's that there hasn't been enough housing built for 20 years to keep up with the population. Who knows? There's all these macroeconomic things happening.
Mm-hmm.
But they are not at root a problem. Caring for them is something that needs to be figured out.
Right.
And can be problematic, but they themselves are not the problem.
No, that's what we are, what we're doing. Even this low barrier shelter is we're reacting.
Yeah.
You know, and we have to react, right? Yeah. You have to address it somehow. And everybody else that's providing services is reacting.
Right.
How do you work on the prevention side? And what is it that you can do to prevent it? Because mm-hmm. I think we're always going to have homeless.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go back and look, just a few short years ago during COVID, there weren't many homeless people.
Mm.
And I think some of the data would probably show this. I think they just said their point in time has increased 13.5% or 16% in the last couple of years count in Lancaster since COVID.
Mm-hmm.
But after COVID, that bottom 20% people, there was all kinds of government support for what they called ERAP, which was mm-hmm. rental assistance income and all kinds of other COVID dollars, ARPA dollars, all the money that was coming in to help people pay mortgages, pay rent. They weren't falling off. When those dollars dried up, all of a sudden we seen the homeless mm-hmm. population increase. And so we got to ask ourselves, and I'm not certainly not a proponent of government come in and solve all problems, mm-hmm. but how as a community can we look at that and say, okay, what is it that we can do? And one of the things I think you mentioned is we should be looking at how do we create more affordable housing units?
Yeah.
And how can we create one bedroom, single room occupancy? Because they're the least expensive.
Yeah.
Not everybody has to have a condo and our townhouse.
Yeah.
That's one way to have, and we have 119 affordable housing units in the city of York in addition to the 120 SRO.
Yeah.
So not everybody's ready for a townhome. And so, how can you do that and address what you brought up earlier in the conversation with people not wanting it in their neighborhood or their community?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a big topic that they're having, I think, across the county,
mm-hmm.
is that counties have in their ordinances to provide a certain percentage of affordable housing. But when they come up and it comes to the commissioners for land use to put an affordable housing unit in one of the townships in Lancaster County, all the residents show up and go, oh, no, no, we don't want that here.
Not here.
And so, you know, I think and the Homelessness Coalition has the data, and I heard it, but I don't want to misrepresent what they've said.
No, that's fine.
I think the numbers of affordable housing units that they're behind on an annualized basis is almost impossible that they can ever catch up. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't start taking a look at it.
Yeah.
And I think the Homelessness Coalition is going to address that in the next set on South Prince Street. They have I'm hopeful that the YMCA will be a partner in that also, taking a look at some affordable housing units and how do you do that. But, it's a generational long problem to solve.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not going to be easy.
I worked for a nonprofit in town, Impact Missions, mm-hmm. for a while. And one of the things I liked about their mission, their approach to affordable housing is, you know, they looked at the people who were already in a home that they own, whether it's a, you know, what you would think of a row home or a, you know, a home with a yard or a mobile home. And they saw that you have people who are on the very edge financially of mm-hmm. being able to stay in that home.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the home deteriorates, as all homes do, mm-hmm. they couldn't keep up the repairs.
Right.
So part of their solution for the homelessness situation was help them do those yeah. repairs so they can stay in their home longer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a multivalent situation.
Yeah, I was the chair of a board in York County. I think they're in Lancaster now, called Servants Inc.
Yeah.
It didn't work like that. You know, especially if somebody was going to, you know, the codes or zoning people would come around and somebody's porch steps were coming off.
And they're going to find them.
And now it just layers upon layers yep. of challenges. And Servants comes in and does that work. It's a faith-based organization. And they do work for like up till $4,000 or $5,000, replacing porch steps, putting in handicap ramps,
yeah,
maybe fixing new roofs
on or
stuff
yeah.
like that. Yeah, and I think that's the way, because those things just pile on, yeah.
and then that's the
group that drops down, and now what are they going to do? They're
yeah.
homeless. Yeah, the worst thing that happens too is the predatory developers come in and say, "I'm going to offer you X amount," and they don't even give them fair value, but they need the cash to cash out.
Yep.
And a predatory lender comes in there, they become a slumlord. I'll just say it the way it is. They become a slumlord and just collect rent from somebody who's just paying them rent.
Yeah, and then they can't keep up.
No, and we don't know in Lancaster or York, you can't find that landlord. They're somewhere along the Chesapeake Bay
yeah.
somewhere, and you can't find them.
Can you? Let's shift to the shelter. Can you walk us through a typical evening and morning for people who come into the shelter? What are they doing? What do they experience?
Yeah, I probably can't do that because I'm not sure what that looks like.
Too early.
Yeah,
okay.
I think it's too early. I mean, what I suggest and what I would imagine and what we've talked about, we've tried to, you know, role play that, what it looks like.
Yeah.
There's an intake. We're probably going to know who most of the people are. They're probably not, except for their first night, you have an intake.
Sure.
Some type of security, essential, making sure that they get settled as to where their cot is with clean sheets and a clean space, and make sure that they feel safe in the place that they're in. There's a lot of engagement, a lot of communication. They're probably coming in at different times, but if they're backed up, you know, how do you manage 8-10 people coming
yeah,
in at one time
in line go, yeah.
and you're trying to process them? So hopefully we have some intake. The HMIS system should actually be helpful. In York County, I know, and I'm pretty sure in Lancaster County. So Larry Richardson is homeless, and he was at Impact. He was at the Food Hub. He was at Otterbein Church. I'm in the system. So I can just pull him up on my, you know, in a database and say, okay, we know who this person is.
Right.
We know where they are. We, you know, and we have some familiarity with them. There may be other people that are coming at the same time. In York, the chief house outreach group is Friends and Neighbors. They may escort people there. They could be having friends or neighbors or somebody else escort. So there could be more people than just our staff and the homeless people.
Yeah.
It could be the city police brought somebody over.
Yeah.
Or somebody else said, here, come to the shelter. I'll walk you over there. So I don't know how that looks as to the pace. And, you know, we're gonna have to get used to that.
Okay. So once they come inside.
So once they come inside, I think they find their space. You know, yeah. basically the inside is pretty neutral. You know, it's a space to sleep. It showers. Do they need a shower then? Do they get it? You know, so they're going to need sheets and towels and things like that. Do they need something that's laundered? We have to be cognizant of things that are, you know, social indices, like, is there a bed bug problem here? Do we have to make sure we take care of that so it doesn't spread through?
Right.
We do have a special place there to take care of that on site.
Yep.
So do we need to take a sleeping bag that they have and all their clothes? And then we're going to have to provide service, you know, give them something to wear overnight to temporarily until we can clean everything up and get that ready for them the next day. And then I just see them as bedding down. Apparently, and then at some time, I don't know what time they'll choose. And that's one of the things we want to talk with Food Hub. It's lights out and it's quiet time, if you will. And people are expected because you are in a big room. You know, what one person is doing can interrupt other people.
Sure.
So you're going to have some type of time of quiet and lights out. And then it's more taking care of individual needs if somebody's has something issue and staff are not in an office somewhere. They're out on the floor observing. Two people, and you have men and women. So you got to make sure you keep them both secure. They're on opposite, you know, they're in their own special places. So I think from then on until people start waking up the next morning is just caring for whatever they may have at night. They need to be escorted or watched in the restroom, making sure they're not hurting themselves or anybody else or bothering. So it's then it becomes more of a security issue and making sure that people are maintaining safety. And then the next morning is it's going to be, okay, it's time to get everybody up and get them moving because it's 7 a.m. They need to be exiting the building.
Yeah.
And then it's back to the site and preparing the site for the next night.
Yeah.
So that's how I imagine it. But working in this population, there are going to be things that happen overnight that are going to be, we haven't expected it. We're going to have as much we can as standard operating procedures to how to handle most events that we can think of that could happen.
Yeah.
And then there's going to be those that are going to be outliers that we didn't think about this.
I think if standard operating procedures is providing the foundation, it's the floor.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the repetitive, you know, predictable,
mm-hmm.
you know, this is how things go. And then it helps you when the unpredictable comes up.
Yeah.
You can deal with it better.
So I think we have good relationships with the other service providers, city police. You know, mm-hmm. if we have there's a physical altercation with two people, you know, we will have de-escalation training for our staff and some security training, but they're not going to be skilled enough to break up fights and, you know, stuff like that. And that's going to happen.
And that's why you have connections and,
and
bringing
help. So hopefully, you know, my view would be, and I'm sure we haven't had a conversation, the Lancaster Police has been at all of our meetings, and mm-hmm. They seem to be very open to doing whatever they can. So I think having police, that be a stop on their evening routes will be important.
Well,
stop
and walk in, come building in. Relationships.
Yeah, I mean, come in, get them a cup of coffee, sit there.
Yeah.
They have the radios, you know, and come in, get out of the car, a place to come. And so... I think, you know, that's a key relationship. And from what I've seen, has every reason to believe that there'll be a great amount of cooperation and collaboration with the city police.
I've been impressed with,
mm-hmm.
I moved here. I mean, we lived here briefly before, but mm-hmm. I moved here a couple of years ago
mm-hmm.
and have had interactions and witness interactions. I've been impressed with them.
Yeah, I have been too.
Yeah. Last question, I guess. I understand you're hiring staff positions.
Mm-hmm.
Are they all overnight positions or is there something you're looking for?
Most of them are going to be overnight positions. The only one that would not be would be the director position. We will post those positions more in earnest.
Sure.
So that'll be in our HR departments. So we want to give ourselves 90 days to advertise, recruit, train, onboard, get people comfortable. Although we have had several people reach out to us that were part of the Food Hub team, so that are interested in continuing. So that's good. We at least have a start because I think, you know, our experience here has been, I think as of yesterday, we had 40 positions open here at the YMCA between York and Lancaster together. So, you know, finding qualified staff and then finding staff who want to work during the night.
Mm-hmm.
And want to work in a low barrier shelter.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, it's a challenging position, but it also can be very rewarding. So we'll be hopeful. And I'm actually very hopeful because the people who were doing it before already reached out to us when they the difficulty or the challenge that we'll have is when the other barrier, the other shelter closed, and the time between that shelter closing and us opening. What are those people doing? You know, exactly. Did they go find something else? So we'll find out. We'll find out.
Anything else you want to say?
No, just appreciate the opportunity and applaud the courage of the church. You know, I'm proud to have been a United Methodist child, or EUB child, and the church saying, "Hey, let's find a different way to do ministry." That's how I see it. Use our facility, different way to do ministry, instead of I've seen other churches just sell and move out and give up the fort. I think United Methodist churches, particularly. We're in a lot of cities, right? I don't know how many were in the city of Lancaster. I know how many were in the city of York, and I for sure know how many were in Williamsport, where I grew up, in the United Methodist Church. And because there was not one in every neighborhood, but one in every community, and they were effective. And when the urban communities start to change, the churches left and all moved out, you know, in my view. And so I think it's courageous for church to stay put and say, how can we find a different way to do ministry? Needs have changed, right? So I applaud the few and the proud at Otterbein that made that decision. And I can say this from a faith-based perspective, and I'm a person of faith. I really do think it's a providential thing. And I think that it's going to be challenging, but I don't want to sound trite, but I'm a person of a biblical worldview. I think it's God's way to use that facility now. Mm. So, and I'd say that in a public meeting, even with municipal people,
because I think the people of Otterbein agree. Faith-based
organization.
Yeah. There a lot of factors aligned, and in such a way that it became obvious to them. You know, this is what we want to do. Mm. I know they're excited to see this happen. Thanks.
Yeah. Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. And I look forward to our further conversation.
We're glad you tuned in today. We look forward to chatting again in the next episode of Hey, Anybody Listening?